Some of you probably know that I grew up listening to jazz just about more than any other kind of music. When I was a teenager, it was really a rare thing to ever hear a jazz tune on a top 40 radio station. I was living in Sherman when I was 14, and some of you will remember KLIF, the mighty 1190. Does that ring a bell? Well, the DJ came on and said he was going to play a tune by Stan Getz, and I thought, you got to be kidding me. Stan Getz is one of my favorite saxophone players, but you just don't hear him on the radio. Well, the name of that song was The Girl from Ipanema. I think it's the only crossover song Stan Getz ever recorded. Today's lesson is not entitled The Girl from Ipanema, but it is titled The Girl from Timna. It's a different girl. We're going to consider this girl in the context of the providence of God. The focus of the story is on a girl and a boy. The theology, however, is grounded in the providence of God. Before we begin our analysis of the text, I want you to recall the historical references that we saw in chapter 13 that lead us up to this chapter we're going to study today, which is chapter 14 of Judges. Samson's father was Manoah. He lived in a small village called Zora. Manoah and Samson were from the tribe of Dan. In the verse that introduces us to Manoah, we're given some additional historical information. We learn that he was married, and we learn that he and his wife had no children. Then there's a narrative that follows that introduction in which the Lord himself appears to Manoah's wife in a theophany, and he delivers a message. And the message is, though you are now barren, you'll conceive and you'll bear a child, and he will be a special child because he's going to be a Nazarite from the womb. This revelation is then followed by a conversation that she has with her husband to gain more clarity about what's going to happen in their family. And this then culminates with the birth of this promised son, whose name is Samson. Now I want you to compare this with, let's say, the parable of the Good Samaritan, or really with any parable. We'll use that parable as an example because whereas parables tell a story and they teach a moral lesson, parables are non-specific. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, the first character that we see is a lawyer. He's not named. He's not associated with any particular law firm. We don't even know where he lives. He's just an anonymous lawyer. Then there's the injured man. He's described as a man going down from Jerusalem on a road. Jesus might just as well have said he was a man traveling and he fell among thieves. The specifics of place and name don't matter in a parable because a parable isn't a news report. Then there's this priest. He's an unnamed priest. And of course there's a Levite and an innkeeper. Have you noticed that so far we really don't know anything about these people historically? The reason parables are written like this is because the characters in the stories themselves are not historical characters. Rather, they represent a class of people. In the parable of the Good Samaritan, most of the characters represent a class of people who should have cared about this injured man but did not. And then the Samaritan represents a class of people who did, in fact, care for the traveler. But these are not real people. They are more like the characters in Aesop's fables. They're there to make a point. They're literary tools. Now, in the story of Samson, we have the opportunity to learn something about biblical interpretation. Parables are meant to be universal lessons which can be applied to all men so that by design they're characterized by generalities so that they do not limit their applicability. However, when we read a passage such as this one in Judges, passages that are not written using unspecified generalities but contain specific geographical or genealogical or numerical terms and phrases, these passages, unlike a parable, are to be interpreted literally in the same way we would read contemporary history. So, Samson was a man, born the son of Manoah, from the tribe of Dan and from the village of Zorah. These are very specific traits about Samson. He lived 15 miles west of Jerusalem and less than 5 miles east of Timnah, the village in and around which the events of Judges 14 are going to take place. Both Timnah and the village of Zorah were located in the valley of Sorek. This is a valley that runs east and west between the coastal plain, also known as the Shephelah, to the central highlands of Canaan. As you might expect, a valley like this was a perfect trade route between Jerusalem and the Mediterranean seaport, so travel was easy, and this contributed to the intermingling of the Israelites and the Philistines. This is a cross-cultural region in Israel populated both by Israelites and Philistines, a circumstance that will prove to be a thorn in the flesh of Samson. Now, I've spent some time on this because I want to underscore, first and foremost, the historicity of the Samson story. But while Samson was a flesh and blood, air-breathing Danite from Zorah, he also is a metaphor for Israel in the time of the Judges. Sometimes historical figures, in this case Samson, foreshadow deeper truths than what the facts of their specific lives may reveal, and Samson is an example of this. I have to take a drink of water, I'm sorry. When I was a teenager, my favorite program on TV was The Twilight Zone. Rod Serling was the creator of the program, and one time I read something that he wrote. He said, "There's nothing in the dark that isn't there when the lights are on." I wish I'd known that when I was about five. Whereas he knew beforehand the secret of how each episode would end, we, the audience, were left in suspense in our living rooms watching our television sets. You might say Rod Serling knew already what was in the dark, and he had this unique way of revealing it with a twist at the end of each program. Occasionally, moviegoers or television watchers, whatever, are let in on secrets beforehand. It's an interesting little twist. And if done right, knowing what's in the dark sometimes can create more tension than not knowing. How many times have you watched a movie or a television program and you said to yourself, "Don't go in the barn. Don't walk through the cemetery." Good stories are all about the unknown, and sometimes they're about the known. Well, last Sunday, Jeff introduced us to Samson. We learned that Manoah and his wife had a son. He was a Nazarite from the womb, which simply means he had a unique spiritual relationship and commitment with the Lord. His Nazarite relationship with the Lord differed from the traditional Nazarite vow that we read about elsewhere in the Old Testament, because normally that was a temporary vow that was taken, whereas with Samson, this was established by the Lord beforehand that he would be a Nazarite for his lifetime. Looking ahead, we're going to learn today that Samson is attracted to a Philistine girl whom he desires to marry, but trouble ensues when she betrays him to his friends over a riddle that he propounded. And we'll see that even in the life of this young man, whose appetites and affections were favorable toward the Philistines, even in Samson, the Spirit of the Lord will begin to stir in him in order to shake the Philistines. A moment ago, I mentioned secrets in the context of Rod Serling. There's an interesting term that appears 14 times in the 14th chapter of Judges. Now, when a term appears 14 times in the same chapter, or even in a series of chapters that make up a story, we need to take note about that word. The word is the Hebrew term nagad, and it means to tell or to make known or to reveal, or we might say to tell or keep a secret. It could refer to either one. So there's another literary question that we need to consider when we're thinking about this story of Samson in the 14th chapter of Judges, and that question is, who knows what? I sort of alluded to this earlier by talking about the Twilight Zone. But this is a little bit different because sometimes the audience, or in our case the reader, knows something that the actors in the drama do not know. And when this is done correctly, this mechanism draws us into the story in a way that differs from how the story is experienced by the actual actors themselves, because it causes us to make value judgments about their decisions. Now, in chapter 14 of Judges, there are four secrets. There are four secrets. As I mentioned, the term nagad, meaning to tell, is used 14 times, so the chapter is obviously about telling. It's about telling, but with the slight twist of not telling. You'll see what I mean in a minute. Chapter 14 is all about what the actors do not know. Now, bear with me one moment while I make one more introductory point, and then we'll get into the analysis of the text. There's one more Hebrew term that we need to refer to, and it's the word yarad. Yarad is an important word because the chapter is structured around it. Yarad means to go down. It occurs five times in chapters 14, and it divides the chapter into five sections, and each of the first four sections reveal one of the four secrets that is in the chapter. Now, I tried to make this simple for you by putting this all in your handout. Please don't look at it now, but you can look at it later. What I try to do, Jeff and I treat our handouts a little differently. I like the way Jeff does it, but I'm not good enough at this to do what he does. He kind of outlines his lesson. I try to put stuff in the handout that I don't have time to talk about up here. So anyway, so we have these two words, nagad, which means to tell, which is related to this idea of four secrets. And then we have yarad, which divides the chapter into five sections, and I've got them all broken down for you in your handout. Let's begin looking at this chapter, chapter 14 of Judges. We'll read the first four verses. Then Samson went down to Timnah, and he saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. So he came back and told his father and mother, "I saw a woman in Timnah, one of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, go get her for me as a wife." Then his father and his mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives or among all of your people that you go take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" But Samson said to his father, "Get her for me, for she looks good to me." However, his father and mother did not know that it was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now at that time, the Philistines were ruling over Israel. The first secret in our passage is the revelation of God's plan. But then we read regarding that, but his father and his mother did not know he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Samson was a young man, probably 19 or 20 years old, when this takes place. One day he goes down to the village of Timnah. It's about 5 miles west of where he lives. And he saw there a Philistine girl. Now, we don't know if he saw her for the first time that day or if he had some casual knowledge of her. We're not told that. What I want you to focus on is this. I want you to notice something. The first thing we learn about Samson, beyond what his mother was told by the Lord before his birth, is that he was captivated by the external beauty of an unbeliever. Twice, once in verse 1 and again in verse 2, he says, "I saw a woman." Then in verse 3, he says, "She looks good to me." This sets the stage for almost everything else that's going to happen in the life of Samson. He is a man governed by the lust of the eyes. The way the text is written, it almost seems like his attraction to this girl is a knee-jerk decision. But of course, We all know that young men of 19 or 20 never make knee-jerk decisions about women, right? They're always well thought through decisions when it comes to girls. I remember I used to be 19 or 20 years old, and I never made a knee-jerk decision about a female. I know all of you can identify with that. So Samson follows this convention of the day, and he goes to his parents and he says, "I saw a woman in Timnah." Actually, that's not what he said. What he actually said is, "A woman I saw in Timnah." Word order in Hebrew is a lot more important than it is in English. And the fact that he says the word woman first puts the emphasis directly on her. He doesn't say, "I met a woman whose intellectual prowess I admire." He did not say, "I met a woman who is from a really nice Philistine family." He didn't say, "I met a woman who is the most interesting woman I've ever met." No, he says, "A woman I saw," indicating that it was what he saw that he liked. Men. I don't know how you put up with us. Then in a matter that leads me to believe Samson was a bit spoiled and was used to getting everything he wanted, he says, "Go get her for me." I never tried that with my parents, but I'm pretty sure that would not have worked really well in my house. To make matters worse, Samson uses the imperative form of the verb, which turns out what should have been a polite request into a command. I'm not liking Samson a whole lot at this point in the story. Samson is operating on external appearances only and solely on the behalf of his own self-interest. In fact, when he commands his father to get her, he says, "Go get her because she looks good in my eyes." That's his reason. It's the only reason he gives. She looks good. Remember, what looks good in one's own eyes often isn't a good thing, as we will be reminded at the end of the book of Judges in chapter 21, verse 25. Samson's request results in a parental objection. "Is there no woman among the daughters of your relatives?" Literally, it says among your brothers. "Or even from my family, that you would take a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" The real problem here is not the girl. The real problem is the covenant that Samson the Nazarite is ignoring. This is exactly what Manoah means by the phrase "uncircumcised Philistine," which happens to be the exact same phrase David uses of Goliath right before he killed him. By uncircumcised Philistine, he's saying that her loyalties are outside of the covenant that you have with God. Her loyalties are with the uncircumcised Philistines. She's not under the Abrahamic covenant. She's not under the Mosaic covenant like you are. She's outside of that. Samson, on the other hand, is a Nazarite born under the covenants and set apart for service to God. I'm sure this girl was beautiful. And when you're at Samson's age, it's kind of hard to see beneath the surface. But there's nothing here that we've read so far that's going to produce anything but trouble. Samson, however, couldn't see past her face and her figure. And it's many a young man who has been ruined by the geometry of a female. Yes.
Were rank and file Israelites at this point commanded or not from the Mosaic law of children
of Aaron? Not. I mean, yes, they're commanded not to intermarry.
And he would know that.
Absolutely, he knew it. Which is why his father. So the question is, were the Israelites forbidden under the Mosaic law from marrying Philistines or anyone outside of the Jewish faith? The answer is absolutely they were forbidden to do that. Samson would have known and his parents know, and that's what he is alluding to when Manoah says, She's among the uncircumcised Philistines.
But that's not just preference to keep it inside Israel. That's God's command.
It's God's command.
That he is blowing off.
It is God's command. And certainly as a Nazirite, he shouldn't be doing this. Yes, ma'am.
Also, it says in that same area, he thought something against the, he had something against the Philistines.
We're going to talk about that.
Okay.
Okay.
Wait.
Yeah.
All right.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Was it the practice of Israel at this time to enforce that? Don't marry outside of the...
I think it was more of a family thing. There was pressure from within the families not to marry outside of the faith. I don't know that they were arresting people for it or anything like that. It was more of a family thing. We're gonna talk about some of this here in just a second. There's a reason marrying outside of the covenant was forbidden by the Mosaic Law. When I look back on my high school friends, I can't name one who married an unbeliever who's still active in the faith. They may not be outwardly denying the Lord, though there are some who are, but as far as any active participation in the Lord's work or in a local church, not one. I'm not suggesting it's possible to lose your salvation, because man cannot lose what God has eternally sealed. But being unequally bound is detrimental to the Christian life, just as it was to Samson's. And the decision to pursue this marriage with a Philistine girl was a mistake in every way it is possible to make a mistake. Now we're going to get to that verse that you mentioned. Verse 4. Because this is a very interesting verse. It's the key verse in this first section, because it deals with the revelation of God's plan. Samson's parents were upset when he chose a Philistine girl for his wife, and rightfully so. But the text tells us something that's striking. His father and his mother did not know. See, here's this revelation, this secret thing, this telling and knowing. His parents did not know it was of the Lord, for he was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. Now, we have to make a decision here. We have to stop and we have to ask the question, what is the antecedent of the pronoun he? Is it Samson, who is seeking an occasion against the Philistines, or is it the Lord? To whom does the word he refer? As a general rule, the intended antecedent of a pronoun favors the nearest possible antecedent, which is in this case, the Lord. Beyond this general rule, I think it's pretty clear that it's not Samson. Samson's being driven by hormones, not by theology or Israelite nationalism. So the he of chapter 4 should be written with a capital H, because it is God who is seeking the occasion against the Philistines, the enemies of his people Israel. In fact, based on the wording of their translations, I can name 7 English Bibles that cite Yahweh as the antecedent of the pronoun. Because you see, when you translate, there are some preconceived theological assumptions that determine how you do certain things. So it seems to be that there's a whole history of translators who believe that the antecedent of he is the Lord and not Samson. But if this is the case, does this not pose a theological problem? Does it not make God responsible for the misplaced desires of Samson? Judges 13:25, which Jeff elaborated on last week, says the Spirit of the Lord began to stir Samson. This is where we encounter that interesting term, pa'am. And the Spirit of the Lord began to stir, to pa'am Samson. Beyond a variety of seemingly improbable and unrelated meanings, the root meaning of the Hebrew term is to beat in the sense of rhythm. I've included a rather extensive overview of this term in your handout, so I'm going to limit my comments at this point. You can read those later. In light of what is written in your handout, I think what is meant by the Lord stirring is that little by little, occurrence by occurrence, With a persistent rhythm, God inclined Samson's heart toward the girl down the street. Maybe it was this thing plus that thing plus another thing. It may have even referred to the increase in his heart rate, which itself is rhythmic, when he was around this girl. However it occurred, God directed Samson to the girl in Timnah. Exactly how he did it, I don't know. But it was a providential collection of a number of things, palms, if you will, that eventually led Samson to exercise his volition toward this girl. It was the hand of God that inclined Samson's heart to follow the Philistine. He did it with a view, that is, God did it with a view, to begin the liberation of Israel from the oppression of the Philistines. We know this is the case because verse 4 ends with the statement, at this time the Philistines were ruling over Egypt, or over Israel. There's no reason for this comment if the purposeful overthrow of the Philistines is not what was in view. So it's here in verse 4 that we encounter the mystery of the providence of God at work in the life of Samson. In this world, there always is a smaller context, and there is a larger context. We live a large part of our lives ensconced in the smaller context, but encompassing every single thing we encounter in this smaller context we call life. There's a broader context, and it's there, in that broader context, that the mystery of God's providence always is at work. Isaiah wrote, "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely, just as I have intended, so it has happened. And just as I have planned, so will it stand. For the Lord of hosts has planned, and who can frustrate it? And as for his outstretched hand, who can turn it back?" One of the fascinating things about the Lord is his ability to accomplish his will and his purpose through the instrument of flawed human beings. If this were not the case, there would be no such thing as the ministry. There would be no pastors, no teachers, no deacons, no elders, no prophets of old, no missionaries. All of God's people have flaws. Abraham grew up in an idolatrous home. Moses was a murderer. Joseph was abused by his brothers. Job went bankrupt. Gideon was afraid. Rahab was a prostitute. David took Uriah's wife, and then he had him killed. As Stan Laurel would say, a fine lot are we. And if you don't know who Stan Laurel is, you're probably under 60. Don't worry about it. We all stand in the shoes of Isaiah the prophet, who said, "Woe am I, for I am ruined, because I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." So the first secret in this chapter is the revelation of God's plan. The Lord himself is seeking an occasion against the Philistines, who are ruling over and oppressing his people Israel. And he's going to initiate his plan by stirring the heart of flawed Samson, who's in pursuit of a Philistine girl in Timnah. Verses 5 and 6. "Then Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother, and he came as far as the vineyards of Timnah. And behold, a young lion came roaring toward him. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily, so that he tore him as one tears a young goat, though he had nothing in his hand. But he did not tell his father or mother what he had done." The second secret is the slaying of the lion. It's a secret because he doesn't tell his father or his mother what has happened. But we're let in on the secret as part of the audience. Some time has passed since he had this conversation with his father about the marriage. The family is not on their way to arrange the marriage at this point. They're on their way to attend the wedding ceremony. But since Timnah's only 5 miles away, it doesn't require an overnight stay. They can walk there in a few minutes. They don't necessarily travel together, because what occurs in this vineyard is without witness. We can presume this was not their only trip to Timnah, because the events that are described here must have spanned weeks, if not a month or two. The point is, Samson would not have traveled in the company of his parents every time he went to Timnah. So the slaying of the lion without their knowledge, not only is possible, it's probable. Now we have to ask, why was Samson a Nazarite in a vineyard in the first place? Think about it. When the angel of the Lord spoke to Samson's mother, informing her of the impending pregnancy, the Lord said, "Pay attention. Don't even go near a vineyard, for all that grows on a vine, in whatever form it may take, is forbidden to a Nazarite." Then in Numbers chapter 6, where the restrictions for Nazarites are given, we read vinegar, wine, grapes, raisins, all things that come from the vine are off limits. And yet, where is Samson? This Nazarite from womb to tomb, he's walking around in a vineyard. Was it a test? I don't know. If it was, he failed. I don't know why he was there. It just seems that there was a pattern to Samson's decision making that always puts him in the wrong side of temptation. If Samson were an alcoholic, he'd have a job in a liquor store. That's just Samson. Whatever the reason, while he's in the vineyard, Samson was attacked by a lion. It sort of jumps off the page into the face of the reader, because here's Samson in this place he shouldn't be, and what happens? Well, he's attacked by a lion. I think this is a warning from the Lord that there are consequences associated with a decision Samson's made, and it's a decision he must have known was wrong when he walked into the vineyard. He had no business being there. He had no business being anywhere near a vineyard, and yet he is in a vineyard. The lion was a male lion, probably about 2 years old. I know that for two reasons. One, because of the Hebrew word that's used, and the second one, because Linda and I used to work at a sanctuary for big cats, and we were around a lot of lions. This lion is somewhere between a cub and a mature lion, but well able to kill a man if he desired. Now, our English text reads, I suspect yours does too, "And behold, a young lion came running, roaring toward him." It came roaring toward him. But the Hebrew text omits the verb, came. It simply says, Samson was in the vineyard, and behold, a young lion roaring befell him. Now, by shortening phrases and omitting verbs, Hebrew writers want you to understand the suddenness of something, in this case, the suddenness of this attack. There was no warning. He didn't see the lion coming. Behold, a lion roaring befell him. This happened in an instant. There was no warning. But as fast as that happened, even faster, the Spirit of the Lord, the Hebrew text says, rushed upon him. It rushed upon Samson. And what we're to understand, and what should have been apparent to Samson, was this. Samson's strength is not Samson's strength at all. Samson's strength is the Lord's strength, and the Lord's alone. And this is not the only time that the Spirit of the Lord will rush upon Samson. It will happen again in this chapter in verse 19, and it will happen again in Judges 15, verse 14. What took place in the vineyard with the lion was a sign to Samson. Whether he understood the sign, I don't know. But to an observant reader, the message is pretty clear. Even when Samson is in the place he should not be, God can empower him to accomplish things that are beyond the abilities of any man. But the strength to do so is God-given. And more to the point, if God can empower Samson to kill a lion, he can empower him to bring havoc upon the Philistines. Verse 6 ends with the words, "But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done." Here again, we have a secret that is not revealed. I'm very curious why Samson didn't tell his parents, because that's exactly the kind of thing a virile young man like Samson would want to talk about. At least you would think so. So the second secret is the slaying of the lion. By this act, God demonstrated to Samson the true source of Samson's power. It does not lie with Samson. It is not magically associated with his hair. Symbolically, the Nazarite relationship with God involves hair, but Samson's strength comes from the Lord, not from his hair. I'm living proof that strength doesn't come from hair. If strength came from hair, I would be a lot stronger than I am. Verse 7. So he went down and talked to the woman, and she looked good to Samson. When he returned later to take her, he turned aside to look at the carcass of the lion, beheld a swarm of bees and honey were in the body of the lion. So he scraped the honey into his hands and went eating as he went. I'm guessing he took a piece of the honeycomb. When he came to his father and his mother, he gave some to them and they ate, but he did not tell them, say again, that he had scraped the honey out of the body of the lion. So the third secret is honey from the lion's carcass. Sometime after the encounter with the lion, Samson goes back down to Timnah to see the girl, and on his way he turns aside once again to the vineyard to see what has become of the lion. What he found was a hive of bees had taken up residence in the carcass of the lion. If you were watching the news on Channel 8 Thursday night, there was a story about a hive of bees. I see people, yeah. Hive of bees that had taken over an apartment in southwest Dallas. Some of you may have seen that program. What caught my eye about that program, because I've been thinking about this text, was the comment by the apartment dweller that the beehive had grown from a small nest the size of a man's fist to the size of two basketballs in a matter of just a couple of weeks. So we kind of get an idea of how much time may have gone by. The events of verses 7 through 9 may not have occurred long after he killed the lion. Now, I like honey a lot. And in the time that Samson lived, honey was a delicacy. There was no such thing as refined sugar, which probably was a good thing. So we can understand his motivation in taking part of the honeycomb and eating it as he walked along. I don't know about you, but I prefer to get my honey at Market Street rather than from the carcasses of dead animals, but that's just me. The interesting thing, once again, in verse 9 is he gave some of the honey to his father and mother, and they ate it, but he did not tell them he had taken it out of the body of the lion. I've made a few additional comments about the honey and the lion in your handouts. You can read that later, because we do have time constraints here. The third secret is honey from the lion's carcass. It seems Samson's holding back these things, the slaying of the lion and the gathering of the honey, for a reason. And that reason very well may be explained in the next few verses, verses 10 through 18. Then his father went down to the woman, and Samson made a feast there, for the young men customarily did this. It came about when they saw him that they brought 30 companions to be with him. Then Samson said to them, "Let me now propound a riddle to you. If you will indeed tell it to me within the 7 days of the feast and find it out, then I'll give you 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes. But if you're unable to tell me, then you shall give me 30 linen wraps and 30 changes of clothes." And they said to him, "Propound your riddle that we may hear it." So he said to them, "Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the strong came something sweet." But they could not tell the riddle in 3 days. Then it came about on the 4th day, they said to Samson's wife, "Entice your husband that he may tell us the riddle. We will burn you and your father's house with fire, so check your fire insurance. Have you invited us to this feast to impoverish us?" Samson's wife wept before him. "You hate me. You don't love me. You've propounded a riddle to the sons of my people, but you haven't told me the riddle." And he said to her, "Behold, I have not told it to my father and my mother. Why should I tell it to you?" However, she wept before him for 7 days while the feast lasted. And it came about on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so hard. She then told the riddle to the sons of her people. So the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion?" And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle." The fourth secret is the riddle, and the secret of the riddle. Verse 10b, Samson made a feast as part of this wedding celebration. The feast is called a mishteh. A mishteh in modern English parlance is a bachelor's party. A characteristic of a mishteh is excessive drinking. That's what it is. It is a drinking party, and drinking parties are not typically known for producing good outcomes, and certainly this one doesn't. To make matters worse, the mishteh takes place in the home of the bride's parents, which you'll recall are Philistines. And to make something bad even worse, the party lasted for 7 days. This is not a couple of hours after work. This is 7 days. Attending the party, verse 10 tells us, are young men. Now this sounds pretty innocent. However, the Hebrew text calls these bahurim. Bahurim, a word that has ominous implications. The 1984 NIV translated this word bridegrooms. That translation was changed in the 2011 NIV to young men, which also is the term used in my NASB translation, both in 1977 and the 1995 translations. If we look elsewhere in the book of Judges for this term, we find it in Judges chapter 20, verses 15 and 16, where it means select warriors. There are a couple of things which we should think about with regard to this word. First, the word and its derivatives occur 198 times in the Hebrew text, so it's not as though we don't know what it means. Rarely does it occur without theological overtones, and it always involves a careful, well thought out, deliberate choice. Note also, these particular men were Philistines. Also, the choice of a bahur, which is the singular form of bahurim, almost always has eternal significance. For example, though it's not used that way here, one nuance of this term means the same thing that we say theologically when we speak of election. And finally, the majority of its occurrences involve the military. And it's usually used in the context of judgment. So when you read about his friends here, that's not what's going on. We can't miss the fact that this selection of young men, these friends that they so graciously provided for Samson, there were some other reasons that they did this. Verse 11 does not say they brought 30 companions to be with him, which is how my NASB read. The NIV is closer. It says they chose 30 men. What it really means is, and this is how it should be translated, they conscripted 30 companions, and they were with him. And they did this, notice, when they saw Samson. Obviously, they considered Samson to be a threat. The Septuagint, which of course is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, instead of reading "when they saw him," reads "because they were afraid." But I will tell you, it's extremely easy to confuse the Hebrew word for see and fear. They're easily confused. So the Philistines saw Samson as a threat, and they responded accordingly. Thinking theologically for a moment, remember verse 4, the first secret. The parents of Samson did not know the Lord was seeking an occasion against the Philistines. It was the Lord's plan all along to create tension between Israel and the Philistines, and this is where the tension begins to escalate. Now, the riddle. Samson proffers a riddle to the men who effectively are a Philistine militia. That is what these people are. They're not friends. They're not companions. This is a Philistine militia of armed men, and he's not concerned or afraid. In fact, being confident that they couldn't solve the riddle, for to do so would require knowing two of the four secrets. They'd have to know about the lion, they'd have to know about the honey. He may have done this to create conflict. The riddle involved also involved a bet, 30 changes of clothing, which seems odd to me, but apparently that amounted to a pretty good sum of money. The number 30 was not arbitrary. It's the number of the militia that's keeping guard over Samson, which is what's happening. The riddle's short, and since it involves honey, we might say it's short and sweet. From the eater came something to eat. From the strong came something sweet. Things begin to get serious now in verse 15. What is important here is this threat. Philistines, certain they're going to lose the bet, threatened to kill the girl by burning down her father's house with her in it if she did not extract from Samson the answer to the riddle. She should have told Samson what was going on. I know she was scared. She thought she was out of options. She couldn't defend herself physically against 30 soldiers. And Samson wasn't going to reveal the answer to the riddle. So she appealed to Samson in a way that's hard for any man to resist. She pestered him to death. When he finally reached his wit's end, he revealed to her the riddle. Of course, there's a breach of trust here because immediately she passes the information along to the Philistine militia who solved the riddle and win the contest. And they did it in a way that belittled Samson. Instead of simply giving him a straight answer, they propound a riddle of their own. What is sweeter than honey? And what is stronger than a lion? Samson knew exactly what had happened, and he responded with a comment in verse 18 that I'm not going to try to explain or justify, other than to say I think his opinion of the girl from Timnah was downgraded. So the fourth secret is out of the bag. The riddle has been solved. If you're familiar with the life of Samson, you know that this is a foreshadowing of a more sacred secret that he'll tell to Delilah in chapter 16. Samson should have recognized his area of weakness and done what Joseph did when he was approached by Potiphar's wife. He should have run. But Samson is not the man Joseph was. And he'll fall again into the trap of a beautiful woman, and he'll pay with his life. He's a man driven and motivated by what he sees. I saw a woman in Timnah. He's not motivated by his calling as a Nazarite. And the result of this, the Philistines eventually will take the instrument of his seeing, his eyes, and he will die a blind man. The chapter ends with verses 19 and 20. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. It rushed upon him, the Hebrew text says. And he went down to Ashkelon, and he killed 30 of them, and he took their spoil and gave the changes of clothes to those who told the riddle. And his anger burned, and he went up to his father's house. But Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his friend. The slaughter of the 30 and the beginning of the deliverance. Well, Samson could have objected. He could have said, I know what you've done. I'm not paying the bet. But he didn't. As with the lion, once again, the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him. He goes down to Ashkelon, and he kills 30 Philistines, took their clothing, gave it to the 30 who had deceived him through his wife. Though we could understand his actions based on anger toward the 30, and above all, anger toward his wife, verse 19 will not allow us to interpret it that way. Samson did what he did because the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon him, giving him the power not to kill lions, but to kill Philistines. This is the beginning of the fulfillment of verse 4, the first secret. The Lord was seeking an occasion against the Philistines, and that occasion has now come to fruition. As for the girl from Timnah, he had had enough of her. Verse 20 simply says she was given, presumably by her father, to his companion who had once been his friend. That is one of the 30. And we should interpret the word friend very loosely. They were not friends. They were Philistines. Samson doesn't paint a very pretty picture. He's disrespectful to his parents. He's ungrateful for his Nazarite calling. He's perfectly happy to marry outside the faith of his people. He's driven almost exclusively by appearances. The only way good can come from this man is when the Spirit of the Lord overwhelms him and drives him to action. And when this happens, it almost always runs against what we know is his natural inclination. I mentioned at the beginning of the lesson that Samson, though a living, breathing historical figure, is also a metaphor of Israel. In the eyes of the narrator who's telling us the story, Samson represents Israel. Like Israel, he's a man set apart by God. He didn't ask for the calling to service. And in fact, by his actions, he did everything possible to frustrate God's purpose in calling him, just like Israel. Though he's set apart as a Nazarite, Samson chose to fraternize with Philistines, even to the point of marrying a Philistine girl, a metaphor for Israel's repeated dallying in the idolatries of the nations they were commissioned by God to destroy. But in spite of all of his failures, our sovereign God is in control of history. Unaware of their roles in the divine drama, even in their failures, these actors accomplish exactly what God had planned. The war against the Philistines has begun. Samson is back at his father's house in Zorah. The marriage that represented Israel's idolatry has ended. And in the end, the woman was given her due in the arms of a Philistine. The Lord had a secret regarding his plan for the Philistines and the way he was going to use Samson to accomplish that plan. And neither the self-centered, hormone-driven desires of Samson nor the rightful objections of his parents could prevent God from accomplishing his purpose. God is able to use the oft-times flat-out stupidity of his people to bring his will to pass. And you know, many parents have stood in the shoes of Manoah and his wife. They may have taught their children, disciplined them, prayed for them, set for them the highest of hopes, only to see them go the way of Samson. Those parents should find hope in the words of this passage. But his father and mother did not know it was of the Lord. This is not an excuse. But it does recognize that we don't know how the story ends until it ends. Remember the context of God's providential will. We live in a small world. There are bigger things happening that are well within the sovereign rule of our Lord. And I'll leave you with a lesson Samson should have learned. Well, he did learn it, but he learned it the hard way. An awareness of our weaknesses is the beginning of strength. Thus, we come to the end of my notes.